But here I am, and it's a lovely, lovely invitation to be here. It really is. And on lots of different levels, very personal levels as well, which I'm going to hope to talk about during the sort of 40 minutes. I thought I'd give you some sort of walk through the visual landscape of the last 5 years of my life, which took me away from my pottery, my studio. I really am a potter, and I realised to my embarrassment just now in my that I'm wearing my pottery shoes rather than my speaking shoes. Real clay on them. That what I wanted to do was to explain really why objects matter and why objects and memory are so interlaced and why trying to write about your family is about the most difficult thing you can possibly do. And to do that, I'm here, so that's what I'm going to talk about. And it's a story that I really didn't understand what I was embarking on when I started. It's a story about Netscape, about small Japanese objects that you carry and you hold, and they're used as little toggles, to go off your kimono belt. They're not that big. They're this big. And I brought one, and I want this back. But if you can pass it round, and I really am not going until I have this back. This is from Kyoto, about 1780, and it's a rat on a bean pod. While I talk. The other Netscape, which I can't show an image of, but when you go back to the Freud Museum, is in the hall, is Freud's Netscape of a lion, which I didn't actually know was here in London, because I write about it in Vienna. But there it is, sitting in the hall, proudly guarding the entrance to the Freud Museum, thanks to Carol and the curators there this evening. So it's a collection of very small objects and 264 small objects. They're losable objects, they're tiny objects, they're little things that you have in your pocket. And there are lots of them, and they are objects of extraordinary power because they're three-dimensional bits of sculpture. They actually only work when you pick them up. This one, which this nice chap in the front row has got at the moment, is a long, thin one, and it works like water. You run your fingers up and down. And there are lots of them, and they are of rats and animals and mythological creatures. They are erotic, they're funny, and they are for the hand. And this story of how these objects have survived in my family is the story of the book. And the story is an odd one, because it's very difficult to know where to start telling the story. The first time I saw the objects were in the apartment of my very beloved great-uncle Iggy, Ignace Efrussi, in his apartment in Tokyo, high up, looking across Tokyo Bay. And he was an elderly gentleman, beautifully presented, European Jewish gentleman. And I was a scruffy 17-year-old, terribly po-faced Ernest Potter who'd come to sit at the feet of Ernest Japanese Potters. And I arrived on his doorstep of his apartment, very grubby indeed, in my very, very old jeans, very full of the wonders of Japan, to be met by this absolutely lovely man, very upright, with a perfect moustache and a little cravat in his top pocket, and was introduced to whiskey sours and Schubert, and also introduced to the fact that in this drawing room there was a great vitrine, a great glass case in his drawing room of these objects. And he said, well, there's a story attached to them. And I started to listen to the story. And that's 35 years ago now, 30-something years ago now, many, many years ago now. But that was the beginning of realizing that these objects had some kind of resonance to this man who I grew to love. And he told me that the story of these objects began in Paris with a cousin of his father's. So, because you're all in Hampstead and don't mind maps and learning about things, you can't actually see it, can you, over there? Can you see anything? This is Paris.
We can.
You can. And up there near the Parc Monceau is the Rue Monceau. Here we go. And this is where the story starts. It starts in this beautiful golden hill of houses, which were put up just post-Hausmann, 1860s and 1870s. And in these houses are an extraordinary community of Jewish families, almost entirely Jewish families from the Levant, from Russia, from Germany, who have come to Paris, one family after another. And there are cousins in the audience whose families have houses in this. And this is the house the story starts in. It's the Hotel Efrussi, the family's Efrussi from Odessa. And up there, just at the very top, is the apartment where the story starts, because this is the place that this wonderful family, my family, settled. They were from Odessa, and they tried to do a Rothschild. They'd sent some sons off to Paris to kind of clean up in Paris and marry even richer Jewish girls in Paris, and the other lot they'd sent to Vienna. And there were three sons, and the first was the banker, who married the perfect Jewish girl. The second was a playboy who got into terrible scrapes the whole time and was a jeweller and turns up in gossip columns, fantastic gossip columns, for all kinds of trouble. And the third son, the spare son, was Charles. And he was ridiculously rich, a young man with a newly built hotel and a wonderful apartment with nothing in it and nothing to do. And he loved art. And he also loved conversation. And this is a dinner list that I found in the Louvre, which shows so much about this man who I completely got infatuated with. And a third of the people there are poets, and a third are men of the world, and a third are artists. It's the kind of perfect, I have to say male, but the perfect male dinner party for a young man in Paris in the 1870s. And he was a dandy. He loved dressing up, and here he is walking down the Rue Monceau in his top hat with his secretary, Jules Laforgue, the poet Jules Laforgue, in front of him, in his scruffy, there you go, bohemian, in front of him, breathing out the smoke. And there's my Charles with his cane under his arm, striding down the street. Because what Charles did, and what's so lively and enlivening about this man, who I spent far too much time in the company of, is he loved art. There he is, at the back of the boating party. He loved artists. And he starts turning up in stories in Paris, not just because he's rich, but because actually he actually loves things. He loves objects. He loves talk. And this sense of someone who actually was a maker of conversation. I'm not a novelist, but if I was a novelist, my God, I would have latched onto this man. I latched onto him anyway. partly because I started trying to work out, because part of my thought about this book was that I would try and work out what every single room that these objects, I hope this object too, which I hope is still circulating, guard the door, every single object that had been in the room. So what does Charles buy? Well, he starts by buying Renaissance art. He buys a Medici bed. I love this. And he embroiders his own E. He takes out the M for Medici. And he's 22. I mean, a rich young man with his own Medici bed. I mean, you can't really make it up. And then he buys from the Louvre a huge golden carpet of the winds. This beautiful, beautiful carpet of the winds, which he cuts down to size. Yes. For his salon. So you've got this, up at that top, you have to remember the top floor. This is far too sophisticated, I can't go back. Tough. The top floor of that hotel, you've got a golden carpet. You've got all the light, the western light coming in across the room also. You've got these great tapestries there. You've got a man who loves talking and is starting to write about art. He starts to write about it for the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, and I spent 6 weeks in the London Library, which I didn't have. I didn't have 6 weeks. I should have been making pots. And I spent reading all the things he wrote about art, and then he buys the magazine because he can. But then what else is in that room? Well, there's Monet. He starts to buy Impressionist art. This is the National Gallery. And he buys 40 Impressionist paintings. This is in Chicago. This is Met. And he buys Bert Morisot. He's the first person to understand Bert Morisot, and he says the great thing about her art is that you want to come close enough to touch it, and it becomes more real the less you can see, and then you have to move away again. And that lovely feeling of a man so captivated by an experience that you have to come and go and come. And lots of his paintings were of tramps or gypsies or of women. Lots of intimate pictures. And he was a real friend of artists. And this is the bit when I really understood him, which was in the Louvre. It's a letter from Puvis de Chavannes, the wonderful not impressionist painter, which is to his dog. And Charles had a dog called Carmen, which is so cool to have a dog called Carmen. If you're an opera lover in Paris, I just love the idea of him walking up and down the street with Carmen at his feet. But the letter says, please get your master to write to me. He's a hopeless correspondent. And goes on about how Charles used to give toasted cheese to his dog under the table at the dinner parties. What's there not to like about that? And then you get this, he buys this wonderful, wonderful picture of asparagus, and it's 1,000 francs. It's 800 francs. It's 800 francs, but because he's feeling generous, he sends Manet 1,000, and then 2 days later, he gets this painting back, saying, this one has slipped from the bundle. And that's the story. That's a story you know. That's a story you know because it turns up in Proust. Because one of Charles's secretaries was Proust. And Charles Swann is based on Charles of Prussy. So the owner of these Netzke is that lover, collector, animator, Jewish man of the world, Swann. Which almost, when I was writing the Paris bits of the book, stopped me so totally, and I had half a conversation with Lisa walking down the street about Proust, but you know, it almost stopped my life in my tracks, like on and on and on, and never finished. And that's something we might come back to, not being able to finish when you start writing about your family. Not being able to start is one problem, not being able to finish is another. And so he also buys Japanese art. He buys Japanese art because everyone else is buying Japanese art, because the whole of Paris is buying Japanese art. So he buys this collection of Netzke, and he has them in a vitrine in his salon. And in the evenings, after dinner, the vitrine is opened up, and these little objects, these bibelots, these little knickknacks, are passed around as part of what you do in terms of having a good conversation in Belle Époque, Paris. But, that's not where it stops, because he's a man of the world, he is Swann. He's someone who moves on, whose taste changes. And you know, Japanism is dead after 10 years. So he starts buying Gustave Moreau, he starts buying Empire Furniture, and I have to say, this is in the Getty, and I made a very good joke when I was in the Getty of saying I'd come to take it home, which the restitution being an issue of some substance, I thought it was terribly funny, and got absolutely dead experience. Imagine a huge auditorium of people not laughing. Really. But he buys this grand art, and he moves to a bigger house where there's no room for these Netzke. And how to talk faster? I'm sorry, because we're only in Paris. So Charles, well, it's 1899, and his favourite first cousin is getting married in Vienna, my great-grandfather Victor. So Charles sends a wedding present to Vienna. And what does he send? Well, his brothers send a fantastic Louis XVI desk. Another one sends a Bellini portrait. You know, that's them. A certain element of bling attaches to the family. And Charles sends to Vienna, to my great-grandparent, the vitrine with Netzke. So the second place that these Netzke have a life, and this is all, Carol, about objects and memory and how they work, is up here on the Ringstrasse. I can't reach it. You have to get... You all know the Ringstrasse. You're all in Hampstead. You all do know a million times. So you keep going up past the Hofburg. Before you get to the university, on the other side of the road is before you turn left to go up to Berggasse and Freud, you meet this, which is the family house in Vienna. And this is the Palais in Vienna. This is our family house. And my God, it is ridiculous. It is absolutely mad. It's completely full. Gilding, you can't move for caryatids. You can't move inlay. This is the plan showing you the different staircases. And it's a house all about patriarchy. I mean, you really want, you want your Freud. This is the house you start in. I have to say, I was outside this Palais of Frissy, not daring to go in, and I dropped my glasses. And I was standing there going, I can't see anything, it's there. I can't go in. I had this big moment about Freud and problems, and not wanting to go on with the story. And then I did go in, and this is what you see. So this is the ballroom of the Palais of Frissy. You know, it's full, and absolutely full, of representations of what it's like to be a very rich Jew at the turn of the century. What it's really saying, this house, is we're here and we're staying. This is not the house of one. This is the house of a family that says, we are assimilated. We are so assimilated that we can do whatever anyone else is doing in Vienna, even bigger and better, which is a very Viennese way of saying things. But it's also an extremely coded house. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to bring buildings alive in this, and spaces alive in this book, and very difficult it is too. But one of the things that I found most powerful about this terrible house is that standing in the ballroom, there are you know, in the dining room there's just dead animals on the ceiling and people pouring wine, and in the billiard room it's just undressed nymphs and etc. You know, it's all as you'd expect in a grand house. But here in the ballroom, which is the one central social space that Gentiles would come, the only place that actually Gentiles would come into this Jewish house, what has the great Baron Efrusi painted on the ceiling but the triumph of Israel over the Gentiles? It's absolutely extraordinary. It's the only place in Vienna that there are representations of Zion, and there they are in a ballroom on the Ringstrasse. It's extraordinary. And etc. Lots of people playing harps. But this is where my lovely great-grandfather Victor was getting married. This is his house. His father had unexpectedly died, and the poor man, his older brother, had gone off with his father's mistress and been disinherited. Again, an interesting story there. Really very interesting story there, but that probably is another... There's one of the bizarre things about this, about writing this book, is that there are quite a lot of people, quite a lot of cousins are emerging from different bits of Europe who say, you may not know, but we actually are related because your great-grandmother actually is also, etc. Anyway, this is where Victor, who wanted to be a writer, was suddenly having to marry. And who's he marrying? He's marrying the Baroness from the Palais next door, Emmy, my great-grandmother, who was young, ridiculously young, ridiculously uneducated, and not in love with him. And it was one of those great tragic dynastical marriages, which was all about bringing families together from one part of the Ringstrasse or another. And it was, you know, a marriage where he spent his time in his library and she spent her time dressing up a lot. And that's what she did. This is with one of her lovers, who's an archduke. And so this, to this unhappy house, comes this vitrine of Netsky. And because it's a house that has had 60 years of high-octane shopping going on, it's so full that there's only one place left that it can actually go. And this vitrine with Netsky ends up in Emmy's, my great, this wonderful dressing room. And this is the view from her dressing room of the Votivka. And that matters because in this room, this is from the top of the Palais, in this room, this is the only place that Emmy has, which is her own. It's the place she dresses up, where she changes herself for going out, for opera, for lunch, for dinner, for assignations, for balls, whatever. It's that liminal space for her. It's also the place where she sees her children, She doesn't go to the nursery. She doesn't go to the schoolroom. She doesn't go to the children's dining room. She doesn't go to their bedroom. They come to her in the dressing room for an hour in the evenings when she's getting dressed by her maid, Anna. And so while Emmy is here in her dress with this view out the window, of course, sorry, because I thought we were going to be up there, this is what happens down round the corner, is Freud with his Netsky on his desk, his shishi. And why does that matter? It matters because Emmy's great-aunt, Anna von Liebert, is being seen by Dr. Freud. So while she's there, dressing and undressing and seeing her children, her great-aunt, Cecily M., in the studies of hysteria, is being seen by Dr. Freud, who the family call a quack. And Freud is looking after her morphine. So, here's my grandmother Elizabeth on their family train going off down to the south of France. And here she is with her sister Gisela. And this is where the Netsuke have a completely different life, because the children are in that room. And that is the moment, that is the only time they see their mother. It is quite extraordinary. That is the moment that the maid, Anna, was allowed to open the vitrine, and then the children played with the Netsuke. So that's the moment that these sort of salon objects, these Japanese objects, these things which were for witty conversation in Paris, become children's toys. And that's where the very first eddies of real passed on stories start to cohere, because it was from my great uncle Iggy in Tokyo and my grandmother, the not so pretty daughter, that I started to hear about how they used to play with them. And the fact is that they love them, and the reason they love them is not only because that thing you've got somewhere in there is a wonderful and slightly strange object, but because of course it's time. It's the only time when there is that transaction with their mother. So, they grew up in Vienna, and the Netsuke grew up in Vienna, and like all good Jewish families, there is culture and there's culture. So while Freud is considered a complete quack, and they don't really approve of him, and Emmy thinks that unlike her friend down the road, Klimt is a complete clown, and she will not have her portrait painted by Klimt, and that Mahler is appalling, what they do is go the theatre and the opera a lot, and this is my grandmother Elizabeth's opera, the middle of the First World, which shows you every single thing. They go all the time to Schiller and Lessing and Shakespeare and Wagner with cousins, and there are cousins of Bear up in that. And that's how the children grow up. They grow up being told and learning that to be in Vienna is to be part of the centre of a great civilization. And a great civilization that understands and values different kinds of people, and it's a kind of culture that will go on, and it's a kind of culture which you must be part of, because that's what being assimilated is, absolute part. And my grandmother, who was redoubted, said that when she was 12, she made a pact with herself that she would, from her bedroom there, she would get across the Ringstrasse to the university, see the university from her bedroom, and she was determined not to be like her mother and marry the wrong kind of Jewish man. And even though formal education finished for her at 12, she made a pact with her father and had a tutor and studied and studied and studied. And the day after the Habsburg Empire collapsed in 1918, she was admitted to university to study. It's an extraordinary thing to have moved across that Ringstrasse, and she became a lawyer and also a poet. And I think there's not enough time to tell you all about the fact about Rilke. You know, we'll leave Rilke, but Rilke is involved. And there she is, the plain, scholarly, and rather fierce Dr. Elizabeth Frissi, who managed to get away from that gilded cage across to a university. And the children all actually left Vienna in the 20s. Elizabeth married a Dutchman, my grandfather, and was off in Paris. And my great-uncle Iggy, slightly overweight, gay, refused to follow his father into the family bank, the patriarchal, terrible, dynastic demand of the family that he should inherit. And he ran away to New York to become a terribly bad fashion designer. He said, New York for him was clothes and boys. And he told me this when he was 85, and he still smiled like anything when he told me that. Clothes and boys. He got away, and they all got away, leaving their parents in that house. And then you know what happens. You absolutely know what happens. You know what happens, because with the Angelus, that whole carapace of sustaining a life in the middle of Vienna is torn away, and the family are thrown to the wolves. And the day that this happened, the front door of their house is left open for the first time ever by the gatekeeper, and their door of their apartment is broken down, and Emmy was beaten up, my great-grandmother, and my great-grandfather robbed and taken to a prison, the Gestapo, became Gestapo, where he was kept 5 days. And his youngest son, Rudolf, was made to dig a ditch outside the Palais of Fussy with the word Jew written around his neck. And when the shovel broke, he was forced to dig it with his hands. And what happens is the family are taken apart. And this is what happens. What happens is that every single signifier of them as people with some kind of existence are taken away. So they are stripped of all their possessions and their names, Aryanized, and every single one of their possessions is anatomized and given to someone else, which is the first signifier of what happens when you want to take someone's identity away, so that you take them back to what you think they should be rather than who they are. And my grandmother went back from Paris to Vienna to persuade them to try and get them out, and she got them to Czechoslovakia. And in Czechoslovakia, my great-grandmother committed suicide. But my great-grandfather finally managed to get a permit and came as a refugee to England in 1939 with my father and my uncle and my grandmother. And here he is in exile in England. And what you can't see is his watch chain, which is on his waistcoat pocket, is the key for his library in Vienna, which he had seen taken apart, put on a truck, and driven away down the Ringstrasse. But he kept the key. So if you want to know about objects mattering, you have to choose quite carefully what you talk about. So when you talk about families and you try and tell stories like that, of course you have to work out how on earth you're going to tell. And if the story matters, then you're in very dangerous territory, because of course if you want to tell a story properly, you don't want people to turn the page. You don't want people to walk away from the story because they've read it in Stefan Zweig and they know the story of the Angelus because they've read it 1,000 times. So the problem is one of hubris. How on earth do you write a story about a family when you care about your family, and can you do such a thing? Well, it's interesting, because my great-uncle Iggy joined the American army and he fought on the Normandy landings, and on his jeep he put his sister's name and he fought. And in 1946, he came back to England to see his sister for the very first time. Elizabeth had been back to Vienna and to find out what had happened in the Palais of Russie. Her father had died in Tunbridge Wells, or ironic places, something you can only say to an audience here to understand. Doesn't work in LA. But Elizabeth had gone back to Vienna and found the whole house emptied, and the Americans were in occupation, and a very nice man from Tennessee showed her around, and there was nothing there, apart from some extremely ugly furniture that even the Gestapo didn't want. And in her mother's dressing room, there was a vitrine, and the vitrine was empty. And the lieutenant who took her round said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear of your troubles, and I don't know what we can do, but there is an elderly lady who might know something about what happened." And the elderly lady was Anna, her mother's maid. And Anna, on meeting my grandmother, said, "I have something to give back to you," and gave back 264 necktie that she had taken from under the noses of the Gestapo and sewn into her mattress. So the one thing that survives this story is these netscape, these little funny objects, And that's how they survive. And it's another moment in the story about objects mattering, because why would you dare steal something back from the Gestapo? And what do you choose if you love a family? You choose the objects that you've seen matter most, and that's not the things that seem most of value. And so when Iggy sees these objects, he's in his 40s, and he cannot live anymore in Europe, and he cannot live anymore in America after what he has seen, and he doesn't know what to do with his life, and he looks at them and he says, I know what I'll do, I'll take them home. And so in 1947 he books a passage and goes up there near the Takanawa Palace. He goes to Japan, which is devastated, and there he is getting off the plane with his lovely tie pin and his perfect handkerchief. He'd be so disapproving of my shoes if he saw me today. And what does he do there? He builds a house for the Netsuke. There he is with his partner, Jiro, still alive in his late 80s. And there they are. He builds a vitrine in the house for the Netsuke. And there he is. This is the next place. And there the Netsuke are Japanese again. That's where he has wonderful parties. And he brings them out. And all these people, his English friends, his American friends, most of all his Japanese, over wonderful parties, are allowed to play with the Netsuke. It's wonderful. And this, there he is, rather rotund 60s, with a favourite mask, which I also love. And that's where the Netsuke end up. And here is his grave, where I was in December, because you go back and you clean a grave, and you take flowers, and you offer prayers, and you say what's happened. And in fact, I took flowers for Renata, who asked me to take flowers. And so in this Buddhist cemetery, very beautiful Buddhist cemetery, there is Iggy Leo Efrussi, Ignace Leo Efrussi, a baron of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And there, underneath it, is the name of his partner, Jiro, who will be buried there too, in his time. And then I will go back and give flowers for them. So what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? And how the hell do you finish? Because by this point, I'm shot. My career is more complicated than it was. I'm trying to finish a commission with a museum, and I'm spending my time in archives, and I'm reading Proust, and I'm reading Joseph Roth, Freud, and I'm in trouble, because how on earth do you write about these things, and how do you finish a story? So how do you finish a story? I decided that I had two options. One was to go back to Japan and try and trace every single village that every single Netscape was made in. But the other was to try and work out why that family, this family, my family, were the kinds of people they were. And so I end up in Odessa with my youngest brother, the place that the family start out from. And you will have guessed by now that the family houses are that one, and that one. And I'm there with my brother Tom, and the house is being renovated. The palais, the first palais, the Golden Palais, which looks out over the Black Sea, is being renovated, and we go round the back, and there are three huge skips. And very cool Ukrainian guy in a leather jacket with a sort of mobile phone here and a mobile phone there. And he says to my brother, who speaks all these languages, he says, perfect timing, he says. We've just got rid of all that shit in the house. And it's full of plasterwork and mouldings and marble and everything else like that. And they've lowered the ceilings, they've put strip lights in, they've raised the roof. And so I'm still on that balcony there. And I look across through these chestnut trees, and I realise that I don't know, I can either not finish this book, that I can go back to the shtetl that this family first came. This isn't the place they start from, this is the first attempt to be someone else. Or I can go home and try and start to write a book. And when I go home, of course, what do I do? Well, I start to write the book. And of course, I start to write and talk to my father, who's in his 80s, about why I was brought up in the way I did, and why I didn't know any of this story about my Jewish background. Because my father is an Anglican clergyman. And he says, it's very interesting you should say that, because I remember a strange moment in my life. My dad became the Dean of Canterbury, which is about as Anglican as you can be. So I grew up in the deanery in Canterbury, which is a very big house next to the cathedral, which is full of portraits of the deans of Canterbury, right back to the Reformation. 50 portraits of Anglican clergy. And my father, becoming dean, he has to choose to have his portrait painted, because that's what we do. So he asks his cousin, Marie-Louise von Montechitzky, who lived up here in Chesterfield Gardens, elderly Austrian, German, expressionist painter who studied with Beckmann, to paint his portrait. And she said, "That's fine, Tasha," diminutive. "Of course, I've known you since you were a boy. I remember you in Vienna. Of course I'll paint a portrait, but on one condition." She's a very demanding woman. She's probably well known in these circles. And he says, "Yes, of course. You always said to Marie-Louise, yes. That's the only thing you could possibly say to her. The condition was that you don't see the portrait until it's unveiled." So they're there, in the deanery. The portrait's there with a cloth over it. And Marie-Louise is there, and the archbishop is there, and the archdeacon, all the canons. And my father shaking. And the portrait's unveiled. And she's painted him as a rabbi. And she said, "Don't forget you're Jewish." And that's where he is. He's a Jewish Dean of Canterbury. And Canetti, who saw the portrait, said, "I don't know what God this man believes in, but he will now remain in the face of the earth forever." Which is a kinetic-like profundity. So what I deal with is the fact that you can be one thing and another, but the stories you tell about yourself can have very big consequences for different generations. And so even small, losable objects can carry with them quite a lot of things. That's all I can say, but thank you very much.